It's The Bill Murphy Show, a daily one-on-one 30-minute interview featuring people from all walks of life. Available daily at BillMurphyShow.com. And now, here's your host, Bill Murphy.
And this is your digital broadcast for Wednesday, August 4th, and we are on location, which we like to do, go out and interview people on site, and we are in the clubhouse on the grounds of what is soon to become Seven Bridges at Springtree Golf Club, and I'm with the man who's heading up the management team for this project, Louis Bartoletti. Louis, thanks for joining me on the show. I know you're a busy man. I appreciate your time.
Thank you, Murph.
This is a pretty exciting thing you've got going on. I walked in the middle of you doing a million different things. Your grand opening is just a few weeks away, and are you pleased with the way things are going so far?
Oh, extremely. Very excited. The clubhouse, first of all, was here. It was built 4 years ago. Absolutely beautiful.
So that part you didn't have to change.
You know, and if you've never been to Springtree and you were to come here for the first time, as you did, and you saw this clubhouse, you just sort of drop your mouth wide open and you say, wow. So that we're pretty lucky to have the clubhouse. Then the city made a huge commitment, took a golf course that was, you know, 20, 30 years old, a little bit beat up, and made a big investment and have taken an average golf course and made it outstanding. And I easy to say that it might be the best condition executive golf course in the state.
I was going to say, for an executive course, and for those of you who don't know what we mean when we say that, we're talking about a shorter course. It's only a par 61. And I mean, for a typical executive course, it's almost a little bit overkill as far as the condition, the types of greens you're putting in. Do people usually go to this great length to make a golf course that's just an executive course, you know, this nice?
No, they usually don't. And one of the nice things about this golf course is, first, we put in USGA greens, which is probably very uncommon for an executive golf course. And one of the benefits we feel of an executive golf course is time. You know, golf has been losing a lot of players over the years because
it takes 5 hours to play.
You do an outing, it's 7 hours by the time you have breakfast or by the time you have lunch. And I think with a golf course like this, we can do a corporate outing. The guy can come out and play a round of golf with his kids or something and maybe get it done in, you know, 3.5, 4, 4.5 hours. Doesn't take the whole day.
Right.
So I think the vision here is that it's never been done with the executive golf courses. They have never been in a condition. They've sort of been for people that aren't real serious golfers, just coming out, you know, trying to learn the game or, you know, just tinker around with golf. And I think this is it's a new venue in the fact that serious golfers, and that's one of our target audiences, is to try to get some serious players out here and they can work on their game, because you could take the 18 greens from this golf course. The complexes are so well designed and so good. The putting conditions will be outstanding. We've got a new grass on the greens called Platinum, the only place in South Florida right now that has Platinum past Palin greens.
Sounds impressive to me.
They'll roll as good as any golf course around here. Good golfers like fast greens, like smooth greens.
Right.
We're gonna have that here. So again, you could take these 18 greens, stick them on any championship golf course in South Florida, and they are as good as any other golf course as far as the greens. So we've got something pretty special here.
You do, and you're in the one of the meccas of the country as far as golf goes. South Florida, I guess you could put some parts of Texas in there, California, with the places that are just saturated with golf courses. You face a lot of competition around here, but Sunrise, the city of Sunrise, is one of those cities that doesn't have quite as many golf courses as the rest of the surrounding cities. Is that one of the things that attracted you to doing this project?
Yeah, I think, you know, first of all, you know, my partner and I own Guided Management. We also manage Plantation Preserve.
We'll talk about that, because that golf course has turned into quite the success.
Yeah, it's done very well. And again, it's condition and location. And
right.
We happen to own a golf course up in Palm Beach, and we did very well up there. But the number of people down here compared to the number of golf courses down here as compared to Palm Beach County, you know, it's a very tough industry. A lot of golf courses are closing, but there's still room for golf down in South Florida, and we think this thing will be very successful. Population, people need a place to play.
Yeah.
You know, the condition of the golf course, the price of this golf course, you know, it's going to be a great benefit for the residents and for, you know, golfers of South Florida.
I think I've been kind of tying in the economy with almost every interview subject I have on this show. It always seems to come up one way or the other. I think Plantation Preserve might be a good example to use. You opened the place in 06, and here it is 4 years later, and right in the heart of that was this recession, or whatever you want to call it, that we're in. How did it affect business over there and golf in general? Are you finding that no matter how tough times are, people still want to play golf?
Well, it's affected us a little bit, but not as much as some of the other golf courses. And one, we got a new product. Again, the location, I think the service is outstanding there.
Yeah.
And it comes back to the quality product, the condition, and our prices are very competitive there. And we've been very successful there. With this facility, I think our prices are going to be very affordable, and we expect to do very well here.
We're discussing Seven Bridges at Springtree Golf Club, Sunrise, Florida. For those of you local, you're probably familiar with it because Springtree Golf Club has been around for years. Those of you who are out of the area or not familiar with it, it would be a great place to visit, especially if you want to get in a quick round, which you don't get to do that often. All right, we're going to go back with you a little bit. You're in golf management now. You're a very skilled golfer. You played on a very elite college golf team. Talk a little bit about that. How'd you end up at UCLA? And talk about the guys you played with over there.
I've been very fortunate, very lucky. I ended up at UCLA because of a neighbor. My neighbor was Evel Knievel. Evel did me a nice favor, introduced me to some people, golf coaches in South Florida. Ended up in South Florida, or up in Southern California, UCLA.
Right.
And our college golf coach there was Eddie Marins, who's the golf professional at Bel Air Country Club. And we sort of hit it off, and I happened to become a part of a team that had Corey Pavin, Ryder Cup captain right now, one of the best collegiate players that ever played.
You told some stories about how great Corey was in college. I mean, you think he's good now.
In college, he was phenomenal. I think the game, with the new equipment and everything, it was difficult for him the last couple of years on the tour. But as you're seeing him make progress now on the senior tour, he's just a talented individual. We also had Steve Pate, two-time Ryder Cupper. I think Steve won 7 tournaments on tour, on the PGA Tour. Outstanding player. We had Duffy Waldorf. Duffy's won 3 or 4 tour events. Injured right now. We had Jay Delsing. Jay played the tour for 17 years, I think 18 years.
Right. All highly recognizable names. Yeah. And this team was ranked number one in the country while you were on it, correct?
Yeah, my junior year was my best year there, and we were ranked number one year-round.
What does that feel like to know you're on a team that's ranked number one? I guess college football players and basketball players could relate to that too, but to be ranked number one in the country, what kind of a feeling did that give you? Did that put any pressure on you?
No, it was great. I'll be honest with you, I was disappointed we didn't win the NCAAs.
Right.
We had a real.
I guess everybody expected you to.
We did. We'd won 12 of 22 tournaments that year and went to the NCAAs, and unfortunately, Corey Pavin ended up getting disqualified the first round because the guy that kept his score didn't sign the scorecard.
Uh-oh.
So, I think in the long run, in the end, it was disappointed that we didn't win the NCAAs, but it was a great experience to play with that team, to play at that level, and they were good memories, real good memories.
And, so then it shifted into golf management. I wanted to make an interesting analogy in this. You ended up in golf management. I'm certain you probably had enough talent to pursue a full-time golf playing career. You probably could have chased down the PGA Tour dream and done all that. So your decision to get into golf management and become more of a businessman rather than a professional player, could you kind of relate that to the rock star that's aspiring to be a big rock star and then decides that's too tough of a battle to make and then get into the business, open a music store, get in the record industry? Is this sort of a similar parallel there?
Very similar. One was financially. It's very tough to sponsor yourself or support yourself as you're chasing that career. On a downside, personally, I never had enough confidence to believe I could beat those guys.
Oh, okay.
You play with these guys in college, and I was one of the better players and on a very good golf team. If you can't beat those guys in college, how are you going to beat them when you turn into a professional? Now, we had a guy on our team, Tom Pernice, that happened to. Tom was an average college golfer, stuck to it. I think he won his first tour event at 41. Now,
right.
He might be the best player of all the college guys that I went to at UCLA on tour.
Right.
He stuck with it. I did not want to look back and be 32 years old and say, okay, time to go get a job. And being one of 11 kids, I would have thought that might have been failure. What am I going to do now? So I decided early on to get into the management business or get into the golf business, and have been very lucky to have worked for some great golf companies.
And it's still work in a field that you really love doing, and I'm sure you get to play your fair share of golf.
Yeah, I get to play my fair share of golf. I think my partner thinks I play too much golf, but I get to play my fair share. And I love competitiveness. I love competing. I think it's very good for business. It keeps your name out there.
Yeah.
And you see a lot of other facilities, and you know, there's no new ideas in this industry. You steal them from other golf courses.
Right.
And
getting a chance to get on a lot of other golf courses gives you ideas.
Oh, always. I mean, every place you go, you're stealing an idea. Or you see something that's good, or you see something that's bad. And unfortunately, sometimes you don't enjoy the golf or the round of golf as much as you could, because you're looking at details, you're looking at things that they do good, things they do wrong, things you would do different. And so it you know, adds another dimension to playing golf, because you're always looking for something.
Sure. So even when you're playing, it's sort of like you're working at the same time.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you're always looking for something.
Now, something very topical. Just recently, just last week, you had a chance to go and almost play in the U.S. Senior Open. You played in a qualifier. You found the time. This says a lot about your talent, because you found the time to go out and play in a qualifier for the U.S. Senior Open. And I would think that you're probably not really practicing or playing enough to compete in one of those, but you did, and you came within one stroke. Talk about that process of going to the qualifier, and then how did you end up in Seattle during the week of the U.S. Senior Open and almost play?
Well, I signed up for the qualifier.
Was the qualifier?
Quail Ridge in Boynton.
Okay.
90 players, and they had two spots. And, you know, I've played enough qualifiers. Usually, half field has no chance.
Right.
And there's 45 players that can't. And in playing the qualifiers, usually people always think the score is going to be lower than it is. And I played a practice round with a guy, and, oh, he says there's 13 birdie holes out here, and if you don't shoot 68, you got no chance. Well, had a pretty good feeling. Anytime you beat par, especially when there's something on a line like this,
yeah,
the field just sort of comes back to par. I ended up shooting 70, tied for second in a four-way playoff, and we played off. Tom Cleaver made a birdie on the first playoff hole to get in, and they had three alternates. Not really thinking you're going to get in as an alternate, but I ended up birdieing the fourth hole, becoming the first alternate. And you know, they had a list. I was the first alternate for the two guys that qualified in front of me, and they have a national list for the 156 players that are in the tournament.
Officially, you were the third alternate for the U.S. Senior Open, correct?
No, I was officially the first alternate for my site.
Okay.
There's 30 qualifying sites.
I see.
They take those 30 qualifying sites, they put them in a hat, and they pick a number.
Oh.
I drew number 16. Not a very good number, so I'm 16 nationally, first for my two guys.
Okay.
Well, there's a lot of exemptions for the U.S. Open that get double filled. So they had an exemption that they were holding off for the Senior British Open winner. Well, more than likely, the guy that wins the Senior British Open is going to...
Sure.
It was Bernard Langer. And so he was exempt. They had an exemption for the Canadian Open winner. Well, the Canadian Open winner more than likely wasn't going to be 50.
Okay.
So there's a spot. Then you have your withdrawals. You know, people that get injured, hurt, whatever. Tom Pernice was on the list, college teammate. I called up Tom, and he said he double registered. He didn't have any intent in playing. He wanted to play on the regular tour. So there's another spot. So with the week to go, I was on Friday, I was 3. I found out on Monday, I was 1. And when I got down to 1, I was surprised, but I thought I was in.
So back up for just a second, though. On Friday, when you found out you were number 3, automatically you're going to go there.
Yeah, I'm going to go there.
Yeah.
You know, it's a major. It's a Senior Open. You're going to go there and hope.
Right.
With you might get in. When I found out I was 1 on Monday, I knew I was going to get in. I started at 16, and the list went pretty fast.
Yeah,
when I
yeah.
got to 1, I said, I'm going to get in. So I went out there, and they don't let you play, but they let you practice. They let you hit range balls, putt, use the locker room and all that, walk the golf course. And I sure thought I was going to get in. And you know what? I stayed there till the very end, to the last tee time on Thursday. Didn't get in. Three guys withdrew after one round. One guy quit after 10 holes.
Unbelievable.
Disappointing, but just got to play better in the qualifier.
And I guess that's a microcosm of how competitive and tough it is. And if you look back at your early part of your career, and does that kind of remind you about how tough a road it would have been to hoe?
Oh, see, there's guys on the regular tour that go to events every week as alternates.
Right.
You don't get in. I mean, they fly to Hawaii, you spend a week in the hotel, or 4 or 5 days in the hotel, you play your practice rounds, and guess what? You didn't get in.
Right.
You turn around and go to the next event. So, you know, it's those guys are dedicated. They're very good, but they're dedicated, and it you know, it's a grind. And the traveling, they have it tough. Those guys have it. Everyone thinks it's, you know, pretty easy, but their lives are pretty tough.
Speaking of traveling, you're doing a bunch of that yourself now. Any more golf renovation projects in the making or in the
future? We're always looking. I mean, the golf industry is you know, on its way down right now. There's a lot of golf courses in trouble. It seems like the golf industry for a long time has been a hobby to people, and the ones that have made it a hobby, it's a bad business. It's not a fun business to be in.
Right.
It's the recreation business. It's 7 days a week. It's dawn to dark. You've really got to run it like a business. And most of the courses, a lot of the courses over the years has been run as hobbies. Our members, you know, have different board of directors. They're coming in and, you know, make different changes. Don't run it as a business. Run it as an amenity. And now, you know, a lot of private clubs are really hurting because memberships are dying off. People are spending a lot more time with their kids doing different sporting events.
Right.
You know, the tax deals now, you can't write off memberships. So, you know, there's other avenues we're looking at as far as helping some of these clubs that are in trouble. And, you know, my partner Paul and I have been doing this, you know, for 14, 15 years. And the only way you learn is to be in the business and learn from experience.
Right.
And we've got a pretty good track record of all the courses we've worked at.
We're gonna bring in Paul for part of this too, kind of chime in and see. You guys have an interesting working dynamic that I want to talk about. But back to the private club thing for a while, just for a few minutes. The opportunities that I've had to play at private golf courses, real, real prestigious ones, in the last few years, I can't remember a time where I was on one of those courses and actually saw another foursome out there. They always seem to be deserted, and we're almost got the course to ourselves. That's one of the rare opportunities that you can play a full 18 holes on a 7,000 yard course in 3 hours, 3:15. Is a country club membership, golf membership, more of like a prestige thing, more of like a status symbol for people, celebrities, high profile, rich people, for lack of a better term? And are people just mostly just joining clubs to say they join it and then not spending, you know, day in and day out there? I'm getting the impression that that's what goes on. Is there a lot of members that just aren't participating on a daily basis, and that's why you don't see many people out on the courses?
I don't think so. You were probably playing them when I get to play them. They let us play them in the summertime. It's off-season down
here. Sure, yeah.
And a lot of these places are seasonal down here. But, you know, you sort of get what you pay for. If you're into public golf, sometimes it's 5 hours, 5.5 hours.
Right.
You know, some of these people that are at private clubs or avid golfers don't have that much time, and there's fewer members, fewer golfers on the golf course, and time is of the essence to them, so they can afford the luxury of joining these private clubs. And it's, you know, 3.5, 4 4-hour round, and you know the conditions are, you know, anymore, I think we tend to spend a little bit too much maintaining golf courses,
right,
keeping up with the Augustas
upkeep
and that, and you know they get used to you know, superior conditions.
Yeah.
And you know, that's real nice if you can afford it, and there's still some country clubs that are very affordable, but there's many different stages of private. And as you go up, there's fewer members, and it just costs more.
At the top tier of those courses you're talking about, do they cap their memberships at a certain level so that it doesn't become an overcrowded situation? Is that something that happens too?
I think they all cap them, but I think the amount they charge caps it in itself.
Right.
You know, it was years ago, it was large waiting lists to get into golf courses. I use one for example. A friend of mine's a golf pro at Inverness in Toledo. And Inverness is, you know, hosted at least 10 different majors, U.S. Open, Seniors Open, PGAs, and it was $35,000-$40,000 to get in, which is high for the Northwest, low for sort of Florida. There was a 3-4-5 year waiting list to get in that course. Always, economy in Toledo's down a little bit. There's no wait list now. In fact, they got out-of-state memberships. I think you can join. I don't want to throw the number out because I'm not sure of it, but it's a very small number to join if you're from out of state. There, they need golfers.
Well, I know that the upkeep and the maintenance and the renovations that you're doing here at Springtree will not be, or excuse me, Seven Bridges at Springtree won't be gone to waste. There's going to be people here around the clock once this thing opens up with the rates that you have and the programs that you're offering. Mark McCumber's group headed up the renovation here. Are you satisfied with the job they did here?
Mark did a great job. As I said earlier, the greens, I think you could take the 18 green complexes he has here, might be as good as any high-end private club in this area. I mean, each one of them, first of all, the size, the number of pin placements you have on each green, the undulation is, you know, it's not too severe, but yet it's severe enough.
To make it fun, yeah. You're going to have some tough putts to read, right?
And challenging. So he's done, you know, he's done a very good job. I mean, it was a pretty weak golf course, and he's made a nice golf course.
And you would think, you know, I didn't know that those guys really delved into the executive courses that much. So he brought a lot of the full-size, full-length golf course dynamic here.
I don't know if Mark had done any executive golf courses in the past, but yeah, this, you know, when you look at the green complexes and the tee complexes here, you would not know that it is not a championship golf course.
That's awesome. I'm personally looking forward to it myself. Okay, I have a feeling this interview is going to lighten up just a little bit here as we bring in Paul Scott, who is the other part of guidance management, your golf management team. Paul, you guys first hooked up when? Was this, you guys go back to Jacaranda?
Jacaranda, 1990. I lived in Florida for a while. I moved to Connecticut, moved back down here. The latter part of 1990, and actually Louis hired me to go to work at the golf course as one of the golf pros at Jacaranda. We worked for a company called Scratch Golf, which was a management and ownership company that was interested in running golf courses as a business, and I think when we got hooked up with them, we both found our calling as far as
right,
golf
you kind of went, we could do this, right?
Yeah, you know, they gave us a great education, and as you know, as we went through the process, Louis moved a couple of times, and we both were operating golf courses in the state of Florida. We had four or five golf courses that we were overseeing as managers, and we decided that it was not only a lot of fun, but it might be able to be a profitable thing if we went out and did some stuff on our own. And so we formed a company, and we did, and we went out and bought a golf course and managed a bunch of other golf courses, and we've done quite well over the last few years, and every project's a new challenge and a new interest, and when we get something like this, you know, to work on, it reinvigorates us to,
sure,
to get out and see the possibilities. So
I would think getting that started would involve a lot of legwork, a lot of paperwork, a lot of meetings. Was it overwhelming to try to get the business off the ground and started your own way, or did it kind of neatly evolve into it?
It was an interesting process because we were both doing very well with the company we were with, and the company had feelers out that they were trying to sell all of their golf courses, and Louis and I think both felt that at the level we were at with the company, if they sold their golf courses, we were going to get replaced by someone else. So we were kind of pushed into hurrying along the process. And of course, there's no better way to create something for yourself than to buy your own job. So we bought a golf course.
Right.
So we had jobs after we bought the golf course. We had a place to go, and it worked out pretty well for us. So we had a good time with it. It was a struggle at first, but we had a good time, and we did very well. So.
But along the way, when the company we were with Scratch Golf was looking for golf courses, sometimes they would send us and we would do the due diligence. So we had been very involved in some of the startups that they had. So it, as Paul says, I call it a master's degree. I mean, you know, I got a master's in running golf courses through Scratch Golf.
Absolutely.
We were very lucky to have them. It was their money. We learned with it. And even though it was their money, I think Paul and I have always acted like it was our money. And they were a great business company.
Now, as far as the business model that you guys are doing now, the guidance management, have you split up duties in any way or form between the two of you guys? Are you handling one part of it and Paul another, or is it just, you know, whatever comes up, take it as it comes? I mean, is there any sort of organization there as to what part of the business you run and which one?
You know, it's been an interesting evolution. Louis and I
I noticed you guys have a very interesting working dynamic with each other, almost like a sibling rivalry kind of thing, where you make fun of each other a lot. There's a lot of joking going on, a lot of stabbing going on. Is that just to lighten things up, or?
No, I think we really hate each other.
That's what I was.
No.
It's a love-hate relationship, right?
Louis and I think, are better than being brothers, because I wouldn't suggest going into business with your family. I tried that one time, and it didn't work out very well.
Right.
So there's at least a separation in the fact that we've known each other for 20 years, or I guess a little more than 20 years, 25 years maybe. And I think we have a good respect for each of our own abilities. And, you know, we're both capable of handling any area of the golf business, and we both do. We're both hands-on with, you know, what we've got going on. But interestingly enough, and I'm going to say, I don't think we've ever had a serious argument in all the time that we've worked together. We've had disagreements.
Disagreements.
We've had disagreements, but when push comes to shove, we think alike so often that we laugh about some of the things that we've done in order to make decisions, or, you know, we'll take a piece of paper and write down what we want to do on a thing to see which guy's going to go which way, and 90% of the time we've written down the same thing on the piece of paper. So
right, and disagreements can sometimes lead to a really responsible decision about something because you get to debate it out for
a while.
Absolutely.
You know, if we have a difference of agreement on how we're going to handle something, then obviously that needs some more discussion and you know, some clear thinking, because, you know, if we're in agreement, then we're probably right. Not always, but probably. But if we're not in agreement, we really need to think it out to make sure that by the time we're done hashing through it, we've got, you know, a reasonable chance for success in that particular decision.
And I think that makes sense for all kinds of businesses, too, when you have decisions that are that thoroughly worked out. Now, what about on the golf course? Is there any sort of rivalry there between you guys?
Well, there would be if you give me the six shots aside I need.
Six shots aside, you think?
The guy's a +4 handicap, for crying out loud.
He's always looking for an advantage. That's what I like about Paul.
Well, and then no matter how many strokes you give him, you can still whoop his butt, right?
I don't know.
Doesn't matter. I only finish 20% of the rounds I start, so you're going to win 80% of the time anyway. I quit after half the holes anyway.
He's just competitive enough in everything he does. You know what? He's going to find a way to win.
Yeah.
He's going to... When we left golf...
Even if it's cheating, right?
No, I don't think... But one thing he doesn't do, that's a nice thing. One of the things he handles is money. I've never had a worry ever about the money. And, you know, there's a good trust between us. We can argue, we can get at each other's throats, but if someone wants to make a decision and they firmly believe in it, make it. And we know that whoever's made that decision has thought enough about it.
Yeah.
And when you have a relationship like we do, if I get my way on a decision, he knows I'm going to try to prove him wrong, and he's going to try to prove me wrong. That's his decision.
Right.
And you very seldom get a partner in life, in business, that, you know, our job never ends. The you know, you may leave work at 7, but we stay up in the middle of the night thinking about things.
You get an idea, you'll call him at 1 in the morning.
He likes it. I like what we do. It never ends. We're always looking for, you know, different ideas, and we're married to the job. But it, you know, the bottom line is we are having a lot of fun doing what we're doing. And when we left Scratch Golf, our boss, we told him we were going partners on a golf course. I think he told us you guys will never last a week.
Kill
each other.
Oh, yeah, well, that's
about what he said?
That's about what he said.
I say that every time I see you guys hanging out. I don't know how you haven't gotten in a fist fight yet.
I think he's wanted to hit me in the nose a couple of times because I can sometimes be, I have a sarcastic, sense of humor, and I'm a little bit of a, I don't think I'm as bad as Don Rickles, but I can torture him pretty good, and he's got a few little idiosyncrasies that are easy to pick on.
And but, I know it.
Yeah.
You know, I can... That's a good part about this relationship. You know, we can get on each other pretty good, but at the end of the day...
Well, and one thing you could say is never a dull moment, you know? So, you touched on something here. You mentioned that no matter how heated things get between you and Paul, you'll never find him cheating on the golf course, which is something that I think we'll use the last couple of minutes here to talk about that. I don't think there's... Is there... I'm going to ask you. I'll do it in question form. Is there any other sport or... activity or recreational thing that happens or things that people do together that has more integrity than golf? You find guys out there keeping their own score, not cheating. For the most part, 95-98% of everybody that plays golf never would even think about cheating. How did that happen? How did golf become such an integrity thing? And when did that first begin, and how has it stuck like that? I know it's philosophical a little bit, but I'm trying to.
You know, I think that it started out, and I'll let Paul answer this too, because I want to hear what he has to say. But it's a gentleman's game, and it started out, you know, what sport can you play to the end of your life, still be competitive, and still enjoy? So, you know, when you're young, you know, even baseball, you know, you're done playing at 30, and you're going to argue with an umpire on a call at first base or a strike or a ball.
Yep.
Well, when that guy turns, you know, 50 and 60. It doesn't matter to him anymore, right? You know, what's fair is fair. And I think golf started as a gentleman's game. Older people played the game. And, you know, when I was a junior playing golf, there were very few kids to play with. I had to play with the older guys. I had to act like a gentleman. I was so honored to be there and lucky to be playing with these adults.
Right.
The last thing I was going to do was act like a young, you know, hot shot or a baby on the golf course. So I think that has a little bit to do with it. It's a game that, you know, older people play. You can play the game, you know, to the end of your life, and you know, when it gets up there, some things just aren't important anymore.
Sure.
You know, and the enjoyment is there. So that I'd like to hear what Paul has to say.
Well, I think the game, being that it's hundreds of years old and probably as old as any sport that we can think of, evolved because more than competition between players, it was an individual guy out there in a, not a competition, but in a fight with the golf course, trying to conquer the golf course. So if you're playing something against an inanimate object that's a big piece of turf on the earth, and there's right. no reason to cheat. Who are you going to beat? You can't beat the golf course. He doesn't care whether you cheat or not. So it's just kidding yourself. And I think the game evolved that way, and it's always been a game that's been self-refereed. I mean, it's not a sport where you have people out on every hole watching every shot, seeing where every ball rolls. And it's got a pretty good set of rules that are pretty much literal. When you read them, they mean exactly what they say.
Mm-hmm.
And I just think that the tradition of the game and the way the game started and the fact that it's one player against the golf course, really, and then you put 144 guys or 156 yeah. guys in an event, and they're all competing against the golf course, and at the end of the week, whoever beat the golf course the best is going to be the winner.
Such a solid tradition, though, as far as the honesty and integrity. It's been handed down so, you know, seamlessly throughout the generations. I'm sure, even with all you guys have said, which is valid, it's still kind of amazing, isn't it?
Oh, it is to me. And now Louis and I are PGA golf pros, so we compete at a level a little bit higher, or used to, at a little bit higher, Louis still does, than the average club guy. And so I'm sure when you get down to the guys that are less serious players and they don't know the rules quite as well, there are infractions and there are sure. liberties taken, but not necessarily intentionally. They just don't know the yeah. proper rule. But you'd be hard-pressed to put, you know, 1,000 golf professionals into a room and find more than a couple of them that would try to take advantage of the situation or advantage of a rule or to cheat his fellow golf pros. I mean, it's unheard of. It happens so rarely that when it does, it's a shock to the system.
Right. It's a beautiful, beautiful game. And I appreciate you guys taking the time to talk to me about this. Paul, good luck with the rest of the project here at Seven Bridges at Springtree, which is on University Drive, just north of Oakland Park Boulevard. Louis, any more qualifier plans for you? Because I know you still got the talent. Are you going to get out there and try to tackle a couple more?
I don't look too far in the future, because I don't know what tomorrow brings. But I'm sure when they show up, I want to play. Next time you come back, we want to talk a little bit about the food and beverage operation here. So hopefully we can do this again.
No, let's do that for sure. And we're going to have the phone numbers and a link to ways to get in touch with you guys so they can ask any questions about memberships. And memberships are unbelievably affordable. We can go on and on about the amenities and all the things. I've actually overheard you guys making some plans for your food and beverage operation, which is going to be top-notch, just like the operation at Plantation Preserve. Congratulations on the project. I'm just going back to that thing one more time. The experience in Seattle didn't take the wind out of your sails as far as trying to do this again?
No.
It made you more hungry.
Yeah. As I said earlier, I got to play better in a qualifier. I mean, you know, that's the bottom line. I mean, you know, a lot of people would have loved to have been in that situation to say they were the first alternate.
Yeah.
Wasn't good enough for me, but I was.
Well, I'm proud to say you're one of the best golfers I've known personally, and so I wish you continued success. Obviously, you're in such great shape that I'm sure you've got a lot of those ahead to look forward to, and I wish you a lot of luck with that. Louis, Paul, thanks very much for being on the show today.
Thanks, Murphy.
Thank you. Log on each weekday for another edition of The Bill Murphy Show at BillMurphyShow.com. If you'd like to be a guest, send an email to Murph@BillMurphyShow.com. That's MURPH@BillMurphyShow.com. A Murphonics Media Production.